Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you once again from Longmont, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman. This educational personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. This is part 4 of the Financial Literacy mini-series. In the previous 3 episodes, we covered tracking your income and expenses using a money journal and creating a net worth statement, listing your assets and liabilities, and calculating net worth. In this episode, I will be talking about my favorite subject, which is compounding. And after that, I'll discuss credit reports and credit scores. So let's start off with a riddle. Would you rather have $1 million or a penny that doubles in value every day for 30 days? I'll let you think about that for one moment, and then I will walk through the calculations pretty quickly here. So we start off day 1 with that penny. Day 2 through 7, it's 2 cents, 4 cents, 8 cents, 16 cents, 32 cents, and 64 cents. So after 1 week, or almost a quarter of the way through the 30 days, we haven't even reached $1. Let's move forward to the next week, and we get up to, and I'll just fast forward to day 14, almost halfway through the 30 days, it's $81.92. So quite a slow progression, but we are making progress, but nowhere close to that $1 million. Let's jump ahead one more week. We're starting to make some good progress here, and we get up to, by day 21, $10,485.76. So we only have 9 days left. And so the question is, will we hit the $1 million? And if you're saying, well, my math says we will, tell me what day you think we'll hit the $1 million then, if you're so confident. All right, let's jump forward to the next few days to get to day 30. Well, indeed, it does cross the $1 million mark on day 28. And finally, on day 30, it's $5,368,709. But as you can see, if you're watching on YouTube, I've put the table up and you can see the progression, that it's a very, very slow start. But that compounding really picks up steam as we move forward, kind of like a snowball rolling down a hill and gathering more and more mass as it goes faster and faster down that hill. And that's really what compounding is like. Now, of course, we don't have pennies that double, but to give you some context, maybe you've heard of Warren Buffett. He's one of the wealthiest individuals in this country and has accumulated his wealth through investing and compounding. And he is now 95 years old, and his net worth is approximately $160 billion, even though he's given away quite a bit of money in his later years. But his net worth is about $160 billion all through compounding. It's not from big paychecks or anything like that. It's truly from compounding out of a good clip, I would say. But what's interesting is if you look back at his progression of his net worth, at age 60, he had $8 billion, which is quite phenomenal. But 95% of his net worth occurred after his 60th birthday. So effectively, after most people retired is when he accumulated a vast majority of his net worth. And part of it is due to compounding at a good clip, about 20% a year on average for Berkshire Hathaway, which is his primary investment holding. And also the length of time. He's 95 years old, so it's a very long period of compounding. But the point is that compounding is very, very slow at the beginning, but it really picks up steam and shows its merit as you get further and further down the timeline. Now, we don't have pennies that double every day, and we're not going to be a millionaire by buying this elusive penny. So what do we have? If you recall, we talked about rates of return in the asset section. So I believe that was part two. And we talked about rates of return of different assets. And we talked about stocks, bonds, and cash in particular. So as you recall, potentially, the S&P 500, which is an index of the 500 largest U.S. public companies, the historical compounded return over the last 50 years from 1975 to 2024 was 12.3%. If you recall, intermediate corporate bonds had a compounded annual return over that same time frame of 8.6%, and 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds, 6.1%, 3-month U.S. Treasury bills, 4.3%, and inflation was 3.7% over that 50-year period. So the reason I bring this up is because I would like to show an example of compounding, and we need to use some kind of reasonable rate of return for that example. Now, you could say, well, let's just use that 12.3% of large stocks. Well, we don't know if history will repeat itself. The last 50 years have been quite good relative to the last 100 years. So the rate of return over 100 years is more like 10% for large stocks. Over the last 50 years, it's 12%. And not everyone is comfortable owning 100% stocks, although as a young person, I might argue that's a valid approach. But for most people, they might own stocks and bonds in something like a balanced portfolio, which is usually referred to as something in the neighborhood of 60% stocks and 40% bonds. If you had more of a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds over the last 50 years, your return might have been somewhere in the 9% range. Still quite good. So let's use 9% in our example. And I only do that because I want to use something that is realistic from a historical perspective and attainable potentially going forward. So I would like to talk about two individuals here. You have what I like to call the early bird and the procrastinator. These are two 22-year-old individuals, friends, let's call them. And the one friend says, I am going to start investing today. And the other friend says, well, I've just graduated college. I have a lot of things going on. I will get to it, but I'll do that down the road. Let's say 10 years down the road. So we have a 22-year-old who starts investing today, and their friend waits 10 years to start investing. How much should we invest every year? Let's use the current amount that you can contribute to an individual retirement account. We talked a little bit about those. They come in two flavors, traditional and Roth. But let's just presume that they are going to invest $7,000 a year into their individual retirement account. And you might say, wow, that's a lot of money for a 22-year-old. That would be 10% of an individual making $70,000 a year, or 15% of someone making just shy of $47,000 a year. So certainly well within the 20% savings rate that we had talked about previously as a good target. So certainly a reasonable target. So back to these two individuals. The 22-year-old invests $7,000 a year for the next 10 years until their friend starts. And the first individual, the early bird, the one that started right away, says, you know what? I'm done investing for now. I'm just going to stop. I've invested $70,000, $7,000 each year for the last 10 years, and I'm just going to let it ride. And the 32-year-old now, the friend who has yet to start, who is now 32 years old, starts up their investing at the same $7,000 a year. But since they're behind the eight ball a little bit, they are going to continue their investment all the way until retirement at age 67, which is the full retirement age for Social Security. Now, let's compare the two individuals. Again, we're compounding at 9% per year. Do returns manifest at exactly 9% each and every year? No, there's more volatility, but we're just using this as an example, an average rate of return of 9% per year. So the 22-year-old who invested for 10 years, invested a total of $70,000, stopped once they both turned 32. And the friend invests $7,000 a year from age 32 all the way to age 67, so has invested $252,000, nearly four times as much money. But because of the way compounding works, the earlier you start, the more oomph it has. The 32-year-old who invested for 35 years ends up with $1,727,252. Pretty impressive for a $252,000 investment over the years. However, the 22-year-old who started at the beginning and invested only $70,000, $7,000 a year for 10 years, ends up with $2,472,918. If you're seeing this on YouTube, you are looking at the graph and you can see the differential there. That's a difference of more than $700,000 for the early bird who invested four times less money. And it's all due to that tail end compounding that we saw with the penny, where it really gathers steam as it rolls further and further down the timeline. That's great. But what if the early bird continued to invest throughout the entire time frame? Well, that's quite interesting. And if you're watching on YouTube, we will go to the next graph. So we have what I will call the persistent early bird, and they invest $7,000 a year for the entire time frame from age 22 to age 67. The total investment would be $322,000, and compounding at 9%, that equates to $4,200,171. Quite a feat. Again, this would basically be just maxing out their IRA at the current amount that you can contribute. Of course, those amounts go up over time as they are adjusted for inflation, but we're just using the $7,000 each and every year for that entire time frame. Frequently, I ask the students, do you want to become a millionaire? And of course, pretty much everyone raises their hand. I think it's very rare that someone doesn't. And again, money isn't everything, but it does offer you flexibility if you are able to create a financial backstop and potentially become financially independent. There are definitely some benefits to creating wealth for you and your family over time. I don't want to say it's the end all be all, but it certainly is advantageous for sure. What I'm trying to show here is that if you are a young individual, it is certainly within the realm of possibilities to be able to accomplish this if you just put your mind to it, compound over a long period of time, ignore the noise, don't trade in and out, keep your costs as low as possible, and just let compounding work for you. Now, if you're looking on YouTube and seeing this chart, I am showing you three different compounding rates here, 9%, 8%, and 7%. And I'm showing you the end values for each one of those. And I'll discuss those if you're just listening to the podcast. As I mentioned, the 22-year-old investing $7,000 a year from age 22 to 67, so 45 years, a total of $322,000 ends up with $4.2 million. If that rate of return instead was 8% instead of 9%, the total figure at the end would be $3,046,142, a little more than $1.1 million less for just a 1% differential in compounding. The reason I bring this up is because many people feel that they need to have an advisor, for example, help them make investments, and most advisors will charge in the neighborhood of 1% per year. So therefore, if they were buying the exact same investment, a low-cost index fund, for example, but charging you 1% per year for their advice or holding your hand, that 9% could easily become 8%, and therefore it might cost you well over $1 million for that help along the way. I would argue that you probably don't need that help, and this is very doable on your own. Now, many times, if you hire an advisor for 1%, they're not going to just put you in a low-cost index fund because of a couple of reasons. One is they're like, why would you settle for just being average? Well, the reality is most money managers or majority of money managers do not outperform the indexes, and certainly collectively they can't because collectively they are the market. And often those funds that are actively managed have higher expense ratios. So frequently, advisors, instead of using low-cost index funds, may steer you into managed funds that themselves have fees or expense ratios well above those of index funds. So that may be another 1 percentage point. So you're paying this advisor 1%, and they're putting you in funds that also charge 1%. So now your 9% return goes to 8% because you're paying the advisor 1%, and further down to 7% because they're putting you in funds that charge 1%. And if they were to do that, and instead of earning a 9% compounded annual rate of return over that time period, it dropped 2 percentage points to 7%, the total at the end of the time frame would be $2,222,417. Still sounds good. Most people will be like, wow, this is great. I'm a multimillionaire. My advisor is super. However, that's $2 million less than had you just kept your costs low and not hired the advisor, which put you in expensive funds. So costs do matter. Small changes of rates of return have significant impacts. And the converse can be true in the case of Warren Buffett, who compounded effectively his lifetime at an average rate of 20%. You can understand now why he's a billionaire. So that is the compounding lesson. And now I want to jump into the second part of today's episode, and that is credit reports and credit scores. So I'll go over these briefly here. You will have a credit report if you have borrowed any money in any shape or form, whether it's a credit card, a mortgage, an auto loan. A credit report is created on your behalf by the three largest credit bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. And they share information among each other, and these credit reports will typically have all of the same information on them, which include your personal information, that would be your name, your address, your social security number, date of birth, employment information. It will show all of the accounts that you have, all of the credit accounts that you have. So whether that be credit cards, mortgages, auto loans, personal loans, lines of credit, things of that nature, it will show you all the details on each one of those, the date they were opened, how much is outstanding, what the original amount was, what the current balance is, all of the payment history of those accounts, a substantial amount of information on each one of those accounts. Your credit report will also show you who has looked at your credit, whether you've authorized them to. If you've been going for a credit card, for instance, a bank will pull your credit. If you shop for a mortgage, all of those lenders are also going to be looking at your credit. You will see who has looked at your credit. You will also potentially have what are called soft inquiries, which are different institutions that look at your credit to potentially offer you credit before you even ask for it. So if you get anything in the mail, like a solicitation for you've been pre-approved for XYZ credit card, likely they've looked at your credit report. If you were to pull your credit report, you would likely see that they had looked at your report. Now, if you go to get a loan and you authorize a bank or institution to pull your credit report, it is going to slightly impact your credit score in a negative way, but it's not significant and it's relatively temporary. for any of those banks or institutions who have looked at your credit report that you did not authorize that does not affect your credit score. You will also see items that may be from collection agencies, if you had any collections, or anything that the courts might file, whether it's a small claims court or a bankruptcy or a foreclosure or anything of that nature. Those would also show up on your credit report. So these are all things that are in your credit file, and you have the right to view those files. You can go to annualcreditreport.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. And it used to be that you could get your credit report for free only one time a year, but that has been expanded. You can now get it, I believe, as frequently as weekly for free. What it does not include, however, is your credit score itself. If you go to annualcreditreport.com, they will conveniently offer you the ability to purchase your credit score. If you have a credit card, most of the major credit cards offer credit monitoring, and you can see your credit scores if you just log into your credit card and look for it that way. There are also some websites out there that will do it for you, but you have to enter your Social Security number and other personal information. I'd be very careful about doing that, even though the very large ones can be reputable. I would still prefer to get it from a known source like a credit card company that I already have a relationship with. So let's jump to credit scores. Credit scores are really kind of murky as to how exactly they're calculated, but they are based on five primary factors. And those five factors are your payment history, your amount of debt, your length of credit history, new credit, and your credit mix. So the most important part of your credit score that makes up approximately 35% of the score is that payment history. Primarily, do you make your payments on time? Not necessarily in full, even though I suggest you always pay your credit cards in full every month. It's did you make it on time and the amount that is required. So the minimum payment in the case of a credit card. If it's an auto loan, did you make your auto payment on time for the full amount that was due? Same with mortgages or personal loans and things like that. So payment history is the most important or most impactful percentage of your credit score. The second largest factor that affects your credit score is the amount of debt you have. More specifically, what's called credit utilization. And this affects 30% of your credit score. So effectively, what they're looking at is how much of the credit that has been extended to you are you using? Now, if it's a mortgage, of course, it's the full amount of the mortgage. A home equity line of credit, they might offer you a $100,000 home equity line of credit as an example. And if you're using $10,000 of it, you're using 10% of the available credit. It works the same way for credit cards. Credit cards have a credit limit. So let's say you have a credit card that has a credit limit of $10,000 and your average monthly balance is $1,000. That means you're using 10% of the available credit. The lower the percentage you're using of your total credit, the better your score is going to be. The reason being is that if you're using a majority of your outstanding credit, the creditors get a little nervous about the fact that you're pushing up against your limits. So trying to keep your credit utilization below 30% is a good metric. And the lower, the better. The next biggest factor is length of credit history, and that's 15% of your score. There's not a lot you can do about this, but the longer that you have shown that you have had outstanding credit and that you've paid it on time, you've made all your payments, there's no hiccups in your file for those items, the better off you are. Also, if you had a credit card that you got when you were very young, it's usually best to keep that open because the oldest line of credit is your length of history. So if you have a very old credit card, you may want to keep that open just to keep that history going effectively. The next two are equal components, and that's new credit and credit mix. New credit is effectively what credit have you been issued recently, meaning within the last 24 months. They like to see that you're not actively seeking a lot of new credit. So keeping any new credit to a minimum, especially if you are going for a mortgage, for example, you don't want to be opening up a lot of new credit cards. That would potentially negatively impact your score, although it is only 10% of your score, but it is a factor. And the last one is credit mix, and that is also 10% of your score. What they like to see is that you have different types of credit and that you've handled them each responsibly. So whether it be a mortgage would be one type of credit, auto loan would be another type of credit, a revolving loan like a credit card is another type of credit. So the more different types of credit that you have or had over your history, the better it helps your score. So that's how the scores work. Now let's talk about the score itself. And the FICO score, which is the Fair Isaac Company, is the primary score that you will hear bantied about. There is also something called the Vantage score. And the Vantage score is a score that was created by the three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, to compete against the FICO score. They're very similar, but the FICO score, we'll talk about that one because that's the most common that you'll hear, ranges up to 850 points. And there are different categories within that 850 points. So exceptional is 800 and above. Very good is 740 to 799. Good or average is 670 to 739. Fair is 580 to 669. And poor is below 580. Now, you might think, oh, you start off at the bottom and you work your way up, but that's not actually how it happens. You really start off in the middle, in the good category. Actually, the national average is right around 700 points, and that's pretty much dead center of the good category. So you pretty much start off in good, and then you either improve or you fall down the ladder. Exceptional at 800 and above is great. You're going to probably get any kind of credit you're looking for. You're going to get the best rates. You might get certain kinds of offers that other people wouldn't get. And that is the cream of the crop. Trying to get above 800 and have a perfect score of 850 really isn't going to be significantly different than someone who has 801 or 810, for example. 850, 810, they're all exceptional. 800 and above. The next category of very good is above average. So you have done something well. You've probably paid all your bills on time. You probably have no late payments of any type. You also have a good credit mix and a good history. And you're in that very good category, and you will likely get better loan terms than most people out there. Maybe not quite as good as the exceptional category, but still very good nonetheless. If you're in that average category of good, 670 to 739, that's where most people in the United States fall. You're going to likely get most of the credit that you are looking for. Maybe not the absolute best rates, but you will get pretty good rates. And again, that's where most people fall. It's when you start making some mistakes, like having a few late payments or potentially a minor charge-off, is when you start to fall out of the good category into the fair category. And as a result, you certainly won't get the best rates. You will still probably be able to get most of the credit you're looking for. There might be some cases where you won't get everything. You might not get every mortgage you wanted. You will likely get an auto loan, but your rate might be a little bit higher. But you're still probably going to be able to access credit, but not every type of credit. And the last category is poor, and that's below 580. Something pretty significant has gone wrong in your credit report. It's likely maybe a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, multiple charge-offs, certainly being delinquent on numerous credit accounts, all would push you down into that poor category. And you're really going to need to improve your credit to be able to get extended credit in the future. You might be able to get a very high rate auto loan, but you're probably going to get denied credit cards. And if you are offered a credit card, you may have to secure it with a bank account or something of that nature. And you really need to improve your credit. So let's cut it off there. This was a little longer than I wanted to go. So hopefully it's still going to be pretty much within that 30-minute mark. But we did cover two lessons here. We covered compounding, which again, my favorite. And again, if you are a young individual, look to open up that IRA as soon as you can and start putting those savings to work and let that compound over time. The second lesson we covered was credit reports and credit scores. Again, go to annualcreditreport.com to pull your credit report. You can also put a freeze on your credit, which I highly recommend. We'll talk about that in the kind of protecting yourself from financial risk, which will be the next lesson. So I won't go into it too much, but look for the ability to freeze your credit. It will allow you to still get credit. You'll need to unfreeze your credit to do that, but it's a very good safety mechanism to make sure no one takes credit out in your name. Look at your FICO scores or Vantage scores. If you have a credit card, you can look for it, see what your score is, and really start to understand how that works and how that can work to your advantage going forward. And again, it's not just about getting new credit, but it could be things like renting an apartment. The higher your credit score, sometimes the better your auto insurance rates are. There are a lot of factors that go into having a good credit score other than just borrowing money. So we'll leave it there, and we have two more sessions to go, and the next time we will talk about protecting yourself from financial risk, using insurance, avoiding scams and phishing and things like that. I hope you have a couple of great days ahead, and I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and a review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend the show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next time on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some. Save and invest, live on the rest. Now for that all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.